Spirit Blade Underground, episode 484. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, a review of The Bad Batch, and more thoughts about some Xbox 360 games that are on my bookshelf, and then also some expressions of thankfulness as we look at Psalm 103. Here we go! The Bad Batch. This one, I don't know if it got a big release in theaters. It's got some noticeable names and faces in it. But anyway, the IMDb synopsis reads, "The Bad Batch follows Arlen after she's left in a Texas wasteland fenced off from civilization. While trying to navigate the unforgiving landscape, Arlen is captured by a savage band of cannibals led by the mysterious Miami Man. With her life on the line, she makes her way to the Dream." That's weird. I'm not sure if that makes sense. Because they're putting the names in parentheses after, like, Arlen and parentheses Waterhouse, because that's the last name of the actress. And then the mysterious Miami Man, Momoa, played by Jason Momoa. And then she makes her way to The Dream, and they put Reeves, which refers to Keanu Reeves. I don't remember him being The Dream, and so that's a weird... I don't get that. Anyway, with her life on the line, she makes her way to... we'll just say a safe place, or a place she thinks is safe. As she adjusts to life in the Bad Batch, and that's not really appropriate either, because they are the Bad Batch, they're not in the Bad Batch, they're in the wasteland. Anyway, as she adjusts to life in the Bad Batch, Arlen discovers that being good or bad mostly depends on who's standing next to you. Boy, the more I look at that, the weirder that description is. Anyway, this is a post-apocalyptic drama, I guess I would call it, with a slow pace and very little dialogue. Now, it's not really post-apocalyptic, because the characters all live in a quarantined part of Texas that might even be present-day, like alternate reality justice system or whatever in Texas. But they live in this quarantined wasteland area of Texas as a result of being non-functioning members of society. That's really the most that we get that's probably... objectively clear as far as why they're there. Why have they been sentenced to this place? It's not clear what they've done wrong. Certainly, at least potentially unjust, you know, this wasteland is, I think. But we aren't told what these people did. So maybe it's not so unjust, because at the end of the day, we just don't know what they each individually did, except, you know, vaguely what they say from their own biased perspective. They say, yeah, they say we're non-functioning members of society, and I get the sense that's a quote. So that probably is legit. But then, you know, a guy that goes and kind of talks, gives a big monologue about, this is why we're here, we're a reject, instead of, they say this about this, they say this about this. Well, who knows how much of that accurately represents what they've been sentenced with or whatever. You know, obviously there's bias involved. We don't hear the other side, we don't see the society outside of the wasteland, and so we don't hear their perspective on why these people are there. So, it's hard to get a sense of, you know, are their guilt or innocence, or are any of these characters heroes? Are they good guys? It's hard to figure out who to root for or how to root for them. Even the female lead is, who's, you know, the protagonist. If there's someone that we're supposed to root for, I think it's probably her. She's clearly selfish and tragically vain. In fact, vanity is a common trait among the characters in this world. Despite living in a dump and looking like a mess, they're still kind of vainly pursuing attractive appearance. Because of the dysfunctional and often outright evil nature of even the protagonists, I could feel some compassion for them, but couldn't really cheer for the success of their endeavors. The sparse dialogue also made motives hard to figure out for me at times, which made the experience feel often directionless. This was especially rough for me near the middle when a kind of drug-induced, pseudo-dreamlike sequence seemed to drag on without any point. In this dreary, hopeless world, every character was scrambling to find pleasure or comfort or sustenance or happiness, but there was no clear goal for me to hope that the characters would reach. The closest thing to that was the pursuit of the dream, or the one thing that matters, as one character maybe calls it, which ultimately was left to be defined by the individual and their own motives and desires, which leads us back to the problem of unclear motives giving me no goal to root the characters on toward. All that said, although character-driven fiction is by far my favorite, that's what I tend to really connect with, I also sometimes enjoy figuring out a new world that's being presented to me, as with, say, Mad Max Fury Road or the recent Ghost in the Shell remake. Along with that, I enjoy trying to figure out what message, if any, is intended by the storytellers. So trying to figure out the world and decipher thematic messaging did keep me fairly interested in the movie, even though it had some slow bits where I was like, come on, come on, come on. As far as the cast goes, there are some familiar faces, and one that should have been very familiar to me, but that I didn't quite recognize. Newcomer Suki Waterhouse plays the lead, and she was fine. Jason Momoa was the male supporting lead, doing his usual gruff and grim routine, but with a kind of a Cuban accent. Keanu Reeves felt a little out of place to me in his seemingly 70s kingpin role. Jim Carrey was unrecognizable to me until I went to IMDb afterward. Although once during the movie I thought, boy, that actor looks a little like Jim Carrey, but no, that's not him. It was. It totally was. I was like, what the crap? Anyway, so there was definitely some recognizable names involved in this movie. But I, you know, still, that didn't result in performances that really brought out the character's motivations clearly to me. As far as stunts and visuals go, it's a drama, so I mean, don't expect, you know, lots of explosions and that kind of special effects work. There was lots of limb removal effects, since cannibals in this world are responsible for cutting off and eating human limbs, and a few people survived this process, including a main character. Otherwise, it was visually interesting at times in kind of the way it was shot and visually the way the story was told, but not dazzling or visually stunning to me as Redbox describes this movie. Let's see, I don't usually talk about music and sound. I'll just briefly say, though, that the music also slowed the pace for me, as pop music tunes with slow beats were often chosen as the backdrop for already slow visual storytelling. Oh, man, my phone's going off. Got to do some laundry after this. All right, it's uncut. We go on. Okay, so I always try to ask myself, is there anything of worthwhile moral, philosophical, spiritual significance going on in the themes here that would bring about worthwhile thought or conversation? It's often hard for me to tell what a storyteller is trying to maybe say, quote unquote, with their work. Sometimes, you know, I just want to tell writers, can you stop being so passive aggressive and just write a philosophy paper so we can put your ideas openly and clearly on the table for proper evaluation? But, you know, maybe they don't want to be subject to that, or maybe they are just trying to prioritize entertaining over teaching, which, you know, I wouldn't begrudge them that. Is that, am I using that word right? I don't know. Anyway, whatever the case, I don't know exactly for sure what was being said by this movie, you know, intentionally, that is. But I drew a number of my own parallels. The first was to that of Hell, a parallel I also draw when looking at Mad Max Fury Road or the Mad Max video game. Despite how Hell has been treated in the arts for hundreds of years, there are a lot of details we actually can't be certain about because of the use of metaphor when Hell is described. There is genuine room for the possibility that Hell will be a physical location like a planet that will be separated from the rest of creation, inhabited by those who want to just be left to their own devices, making their own rules, and maybe even attempting to hold together their own sort of society. God would still oversee that and ensure that no one suffers any more than they are due, but it could still look a lot like the worlds we see in movies like The Bad Batch and Mad Max Fury Road, I think. Now, for more of my thoughts on Hell and what the Bible does and doesn't actually say about it, I'll try to put a link in the YouTube description to a video I made on the subject. I'm in a big crunch, so if I forget, you can just do a search on this channel for, is Hell Is hell really what we think it is? I think is the name of that video. Probably if you just put in hell, that'll get you there. Anyway, the second parallel I saw was not to a potential future life in hell, but to actually this present life, which I think of the two is the more likely intended theme from the writer. Our world is just so obviously broken, filled with people just scrambling for pleasure, purpose, admiration, love, and happiness. But the evil and dysfunction of those around us and our own evil and dysfunction prevent us from having the things that we want most in life. Or we obtain them maybe, but only in a limited or just this kind of tainted, broken, dysfunctional form. In the movie, one option is to live in a town called Comfort, where comfort and convenience is prioritized and there is more order. But the ultimate goal turns out to be little more than just kind of perpetuating life, or as my pastor calls it, pumping blood. We're just kind of surviving to survive and you know, getting what comfort we can in the process. The other option presented in this world is to live more freely out in the wasteland, but in that place, people literally cannibalize each other in pursuit of what they want. There's also arguably a message here about the vanity of pursuing physical attractiveness to such a great degree, as many characters, especially the female lead, seem just like tragically concerned about their appearance, even in the post-apocalyptic wasteland where there are much greater concerns at stake. It may be that the movie's intended final message, as I kind of see it in the final scene, is that we should take small moments of beauty and love where we can find them, flawed as they are. But that felt like a far cry from a happy ending to me, if that was the message. And it just kind of reminded me of our need for a rescuer, someone to fix our brokenness and save us from ourselves and the mess we've made for ourselves and each other, both as a species and as individuals. Now, I have no idea what your tastes are in movies, but if I were a time traveler, I would go back in time and say, hey, Peter, skip this one. Skip it. Because you know other movies with similar themes that you would have a better time just watching again instead of watching this movie for the first time. It has an interesting world and themes, but you won't often be in the mood for a movie that moves this slowly or keeps its characters' motivations this kind of obscured or vague. It's rated R for violence, language, some drug content, and brief nudity. And on the nudity front, it's a woman briefly looking at a magazine with pictures of nude women in it. It's kind of at an angle, so it is brief and not like a terribly great view of it. So I want to remind you guys to check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS Helix Reviews, and the Retro Rewind podcast. For more information about the CGC network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. Welcome to part 11 of my bookshelf tour, still based on footage taken from my bookshelf at our old house, because my bookshelf hasn't been completely reconstituted in our new house. So I left off looking at some 360 video games. We might even get into some PS4 stuff today. We'll see. We're just going to see how much I can get through talking about in 10 minutes. So here we go. Boom. Lost Odyssey. Okay, this is a turn-based RPG for the Xbox 360. It was among the first games that I bought for that system. It has a lot in common with Shadow Hearts, which I really love, the combat system in Shadow Hearts, which is turn-based but still has this, you know, reflex or hand-eye, or more of a timing, I would say, mechanism involved in executing, you know, the moves in combat. I don't like it near as much as the spinning dial in Shadow Hearts, but I think it's a pretty good second. I still haven't finished this game. I do fully intend to. It's just I'm not always in the mood for a turn-based RPG, especially a Japanese RPG. I'm close to the end on this game, actually. I just need to do some serious level grinding, which, you know, level grinding of the same enemies over and over and over again, it's a bit unfortunate, you know. So anyway, it's not one that I can recommend to everybody, but of the JRPGs that I've played, it definitely has a much more serious tone overall than the vast majority of them, and I really appreciate that. But I do get tired of old JRPG conventions, like having to talk to everyone in town in order to trigger game advancement. You know, limited save points is also an annoyance, and the anime voice, the anime style voice acting and silly characters. You know, though, as I said, still mostly a serious game. So it's in my collection, and that's why it stays in my collection. But it's not one I'm super excited about. Marvel Ultimate Alliance. Now I still haven't finished this one. I got halfway through it once, and I hit a wall with like a side-scrolling platforming section that was unlike the rest of the gameplay, where if you fall, you have to go and start the whole thing over again, and I just hate that kind of gameplay. So I actually got rid of it for a while, and then years later, I bought it again really cheap, just to kind of have as a game to play with other people when they come over, or maybe to play with my boys now at this point. But I love Diablo clones, and I love superheroes. So as long as I can, you know, maybe get through that side-scrolling part again once we reach it, then that'll be fine. Let's see. I do hack away at this a little around once a year, maybe. I last left off in a swimming level. Yay! So that wasn't very fun for me, so that's why I kind of last put the controller down on this one. I would like to finish it someday, but, you know, maybe just doing couch co-op with my boys, I don't know if by itself, just me playing it by myself, it's ever going to be a real draw for me like it used to be. Portal 2. Now, I am not a fan of puzzle games, but I got on a streak with Portal 1 and 2 years ago. Discovered how much I enjoyed the first one, which I own digitally, and then bought this one, and I think loved it even more. The story elements were great, and they were the main thing actually that drove me forward, understanding this world and the stories, and, you know, what was going on with this weird AI that was leading me through the tests in the first game. Is this AI broken? And then slowly the true state of things begins to be revealed, and the second one went much further, you know, revealing more and more of the world and the characters and stuff and the powers that be. Now and then a puzzle would kind of frustrate me, and I'd just look it up because, you know, I just don't like puzzles all that much. But otherwise, it was such a great experience, and it, you know, I have to admit, it was satisfying when I found the solution to each puzzle. You have that little moment where you feel smart, you know. Sacred 2 Fallen Angel. Okay, this is an open-world Diablo clone. Tons of story text to read if you want in the numerous quests. I don't read any of it. I just follow the waypoints to kill, loot, and upgrade. It's kind of stuttery in terms of its frame rate on Xbox 360. There's some ugly, bland models here and there, but the looting/upgrade cycle is great, for my taste anyway. And instead of, like, swarming monsters, which you see a lot in Diablo 3 and in other Diablo clones that have come about since Diablo 3 or around the same time as Diablo 3, instead of like these swarming monsters, each monster has more threat and significance. You know, like the Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance games and the Champions of Norrath game on the PlayStation 2. Yes, there are groups of enemies still, but not like these swarms that to me just at some point feels like a real-time strategy game instead of like an action RPG. I played a bit of several classes in this game, Sacred 2, a while back. The controls took a little getting used to. It felt weird to me. They still, every once in a while, feel like, oh, this is a little bit weird and not intuitive at all. And so I just kind of lost interest, but then recently I came back to it to give it another try, and for some reason, something clicked. It just totally hooked me like never before. It was like a return to those non-swarmy Diablo clones, you know, that I mentioned, Champions of Norrath and Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance. I did turn off the voice acting. The script and the voice acting is sometimes intentionally cheesy, and it can get some good laughs out of me, but a lot more hits than misses for me in the laughs department, so I ended up eventually just turning the voice acting off. All right, Saints Row the Third. After running out of open-world RPGs, I started exploring open-world action games, which I used to not touch action games, but slowly over time, starting with Bioshock, I slowly started dipping my toe more and more into the world of action games because of difficulty settings that would allow someone with my crappy skills to still get through them and enjoy them. So after running out of open world RPGs, started exploring open world action games, and this might have been the first. With all the XP and cash earning elements, it's basically an action RPG, but it does have some story missions requiring action skills. Those were frustrating at times, but totally worth it for me for all the open world fun that I had. The world is a bit bonkers, but still just grounded enough to scratch my itch to fantasize about doing ridiculous, almost superheroic feats in the real world. I cannot recommend this game to nearly anyone I know personally, as most would be really put off, disgusted, or possibly even morally compromised by some of the crass, sexually themed content in the game. It's not like a constant barrage of that kind of content, but it's peppered throughout the game experience. I even put the game away myself for a while because of issues related to that kind of thing, but I found I was okay to come back to it later when I was just kind of in a different season spiritually. So to sum up, I love playing this game, and yet I don't necessarily recommend that you give it a try. Singularity. Now, this is considered to be a BioShock knockoff by many, at least it was at the time of its release. I discovered it years after the BioShock trilogy had ended, with, you know, no more BioShock games planned for release. In that space where no BioShock games are coming, a BioShock knockoff suddenly looks pretty good. It's a first-person shooter with some light puzzle solving centered on time displacement, a time displacement gadget, you know, which would be in place of kind of like the powers and abilities you would have in a BioShock game. And you can use these time displacement gadget powers to reverse or advance the flow of time on enemies or objects. This makes for some really cool possibilities both in and out of combat. Time travel is also involved, as you can imagine. If you enjoyed BioShock, I highly recommend giving Singularity a try. Star Ocean: The Last Hope. I tried starting this a couple times without success. I bought it really cheap when I was in a JRPG phase a few years ago, but the anime-style characters and voice acting just killed it for me really quickly. I imagine it will be joining my cell pile pretty soon. Two Worlds. Now, I just finished releasing a four-part playthrough series for this game back in September, which you can check out on this channel. Of all my games, this may be the irritating game that I love most. It's one of my favorite open-world action RPGs for its looting, crafting, and progression systems. But on the 360, the graphics are bland, the frame rate can get crazy choppy, especially when you go into dungeons, it crashes, numerous quests are broken and unable to be completed, the dialogue is weird, and the voice acting done by the development staff instead of actual voice actors, it's largely kind of a mess. But I love the gameplay system so much that I've actually played it twice now, and it's been well worth pushing past the downsides both times. Check the description below if I remember to put a link there for a link to part one of my playthrough of that series. Two Worlds 2, also a good open-world third-person action RPG. It has better graphics, better writing, better voice acting, but the revamped crafting and magic systems kind of sucked a lot of the fun out of it for me. I didn't like them as much as I did the first one. It did review a lot better than the first one, and I definitely enjoyed it, but not as much as the first game by far. All right, we are finally moving into PS4 games. Just really briefly, we'll just barely get started on them. Starting with Dragon Quest Builders. Now, I reviewed this game when it came out and really enjoyed it at first. The collecting and crafting was really working for me. I enjoyed the Dragon Quest trappings. I don't have a ton of nostalgia for the series, but some. So, you know, the artwork, the enemies, the music, and the sound effects are all very true to that series, as that series has remained very consistent in those elements throughout. So they carried that over even into this type of game that was totally different gameplay from the main Dragon Quest series. It's, you know, it's like a Minecraft type of, you know, knockoff, but with smoother graphics and a lot more polygons. But eventually, you know, I did lose consistent interest with this game. I took almost a year away from it after getting more than halfway through, and then came back and finished it. I don't know exactly why the hook wasn't as strong near the end. In some ways, I wanted more freedom to just explore and survive in kind of an open, craftable world. But when given an option like that in the post-game, I quickly lost interest without having goals and rewards. So I'm not sure what I want. I didn't want to have to learn crafting recipes through monotonous experimentation, and yet I didn't feel like having all the recipes in the post-game world made that experience better. Maybe if something about the survival gameplay would have been different, I'm not quite sure why I kind of lost interest in this. I got enough interest when coming back to it, you know, to finish it off, but it wasn't like my one main game that I was totally just kind of into, forsaking all others until it was done, you know. I will probably buy the second one when it comes out in the US because I did enjoy the first one enough, but it wasn't the Minecraft with more polygons that I kind of had hoped it would be. So anyway, okay, that's it. That's all I have time for. Next time we will pick it up and I will talk about Dragon Age Inquisition. I definitely have some opinions about that, so hopefully you'll join me for that next time.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
This week at SpiritBlade.com, the Christmas sale has begun. It's running from, as I record this, actually November 22nd. I was saying November 23rd in like some of the bumpers that I was putting before videos, but I just was like, I just need to launch this sale so I don't accidentally forget, because the 23rd is Thanksgiving. I'll be off. So I knew I wanted to start it sometime today. So I just launched it first thing in the morning. So anyway, that's going to run now through December 10th. And I'm discounting specifically audio drama CD sets and also gift codes. So if you'd like to give one of those to a friend or family member this Christmas season, I have discounted those for that purpose. So hopefully that will be useful to you guys. What else? At youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, we've reached 1,000 subscribers. Holy crap. So I put a video up kind of reacting to that, not quite celebrating it, but then asking the question, how should we celebrate that? Do you guys want to do like a live Q&A or an AMA or whatever those are called? Or do you have another idea in mind? So if you want to share your thoughts on that, go over to youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral and find that video, 1,000 subscribers, how should we celebrate? And leave your thoughts in the comments, and then I will probably try to based on comments and suggestions, brainstorm and come up with something that I'll schedule for January, since right about now, I'm guessing we're all going to be a little bit too busy to effectively get together and participate in whatever it is that I decide to do. So, and then also on our channel on YouTube, you'll find my uncut review of The Bad Batch, and then also the Bookshelf Tour installment, which is part 11 in that that series. Holy crap. And you'll also find in the video version of that some visuals to go along with the stuff that I'm talking about that hopefully will be extra fun for you. While you're there, if you want to like, share, and subscribe, that does help to grow our community, so I'd appreciate that. I want to get to 10,000 now. Isn't that the next thing? Or five? I don't know what the next big benchmark is, but anyway, it would just be great to see that community and just engagement level there continue to grow, and the number of people and the level of involvement that that individuals have as they kind of connect with that channel. So let's see, what else? I think that is about it. I would be grateful, guys, if you'd leave a review of our audio dramas on iTunes or Amazon. Reviews and ratings for this podcast on iTunes or other podcatchers would be greatly appreciated as well. That's it. All right, let's keep going.
The truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
Taking a little detour from what we normally do in this segment of the podcast, and this is actually exclusive to the podcast. I'm not making a video version of this to put on the YouTube channel, as I have been doing lately, largely due to the fact that I'm just in the middle of a huge crunch, and it was just a little bit simpler to only do this as an audio version for the podcast. So anyway, if you're not familiar with this podcast or this segment, basically right now I'm going to attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the what I would call the churchy language that we often take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply at least some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth, and that's something that we can all do, so I hope you'll do that with me. We've been going through the book of Ephesians, and I apologize again, guys, that we are not back in the book of Ephesians. The last thing in Ephesians I did was Ephesians 5, chapter 5, 11 through 14, part 1, and took this massive break. I am hoping to get to 5, 11 through 14, part 2 next week, but right now, I'm actually going to take a look at Psalm 103, as those of us in America prepare to kind of get into the celebration of Thanksgiving. But this is something that really all of us can do all year long, and really we really shouldn't wait for a holiday to kind of express our thankfulness to God. I think Psalm 103 is kind of bent in that direction, and so I wanted to just read Psalm 103, and I'm not going to go near as deep in, you know, into kind of a line by line exegesis examination, you know, of the an interpretation of the text as I usually do. Instead, again, partly because of the crunch in time, but also just because sometimes it's good to just kind of let the text breathe and speak on its own a little bit. Instead, I'm just going to read this psalm, then I'll go back and comment on a few of the verses in the psalm, and then I'll read through it again to wrap up. So this is a psalm of David, Psalm 103. I'll read it in the ESV, which reads, "Bless Yahweh, O my soul." And I apologize, I've just gotten into the habit of putting in Yahweh. Whenever in the Old Testament we see L-O-R-D in all caps, that's something that editors just choose to do in place of putting God's name, the Tetragrammaton, which there's some questions about the pronunciation. There are a number of accepted pronunciations. The one that is very common, very popular, and that I tend to use is, well, I guess a little more technically it would be Yahweh. Not quite the spitting sound, but Yahweh. Yahweh, actually, you don't have the A sound, but Yahweh. But the more Americanized is Yahweh. So anyway, if you're a first-time listener and you're confused, what the crap is Peter doing? I just prefer to inject God's personal name that he gave to be called by when he spoke to Moses. So anyway, that's what that's about. Sorry for that weird rabbit trail. I was not intending to go that direction at all. But anyway, going back. Psalm 103 in the ESV with that exception, starting in verse 1, this is a psalm of David, and it reads, "Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good, so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. Yahweh works righteousness and justice for all who are oppressed. He made known his ways to Moses, his acts to the people of Israel. Yahweh is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. As a father shows compassion to his children, so Yahweh shows compassion to those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field, for the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. But the steadfast love of Yahweh is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to those who keep his covenant and remember to do his commandments. Yahweh has established his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom rules over all. Bless Yahweh, O you his angels, you mighty ones who do his word, obeying the voice of his word. Bless Yahweh, all his hosts, his ministers who do his will. Bless Yahweh, all his works in all places of his dominion. Bless Yahweh, O my soul." All right, well, some general things to keep in mind as we look at this psalm. This psalm was written by David, like by a specific person, and it was reflecting on his personal experiences and within the context of God's covenant relationship with Israel at that time. So I think it's important, you know, just to remember that we should be careful when applying psalms to our lives and situations. We don't want to get kind of loosey-goosey and just treat them like a letter that we received in our email just today, you know. Now, that said, we can still take encouragement from God's character revealed in the Psalms and inspiration from the psalmist's outlook on life in light of who God is and what he has done. Those general just kind of observations aside, first I want to look at verse 1, which says, "Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name." Bless is one of those churchy words I want to unpack just briefly. It basically means to kneel as an act of adoration, to adore. Yahweh, to think about who he is, reflect on that, and just adore who he is. We don't use that word very often. It's one of the few that has not been stolen by this kind of age of hyperbolic language where words are used and abused and lose all their power. Adore has not had that happen to it yet, I don't think. And so I think it still kind of communicates this idea of just loving, valuing Yahweh for who he is, and specifically blessing his holy name, which in the time that this was written, someone's name wrapped up not just like the sound that they were identified by when people spoke, but it represented their character, it represented their attributes. And so we are to adore the holy, which is another kind of churchy word that just means basically set apart for the unique purposes of God. So God is kind of just other and set apart to his own unique purposes, you know? So we are to adore his set apart, different, unique attributes and character. Then looking at verse 3, says, "Who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases." I had to kind of stop and ask myself, do I appreciate his forgiveness? The fact that he forgives all my iniquity. Do I feel like I need it? You know, or do I kind of fall into thinking, you know, yeah, I'm a pretty good guy. I think, you know, compared to whatever, you know, person I conjured in my mind or whatever type of person I conjured in my mind, you know, oh, at least I'm better than those kind of, oh, I'm a pretty good guy. You know, oh, as Christians go, I'm pretty good or whatever. Do I really appreciate his forgiveness? Am I really making the right comparison in my mind to the holiness of God? Do I appreciate his forgiveness and that he forgives all my iniquity? And then also there's this reference to who heals all your diseases, the psalmist says. Our vulnerability to microscopic organisms or defects in DNA are the result of the presence of sin in the world. God did not cause those things. He is not to blame for those things. And not every disease we have will be healed. But every disease we are healed from is because of God. And means that he makes possible or brings about that healing. I think is certainly what we can take away from this. Verse 6, Yahweh works righteousness and justice for all who are oppressed. We often don't see justice done in this life, what little measure there is exists because of God's activity in the world. He has implanted in the hearts even of unbelievers a measure of understanding regarding justice, what is right and wrong. And so he is to be thanked when even a small measure of justice is seen in this world. And even now, he is preparing a day, storing up wrath to punish the guilty, those who just refuse to the very end and forever to not repent, you know, and not acknowledge any guilt on their part, but just say, nope, I'm not guilty here, and I don't need forgiveness. I don't want your forgiveness. You know, God is storing up wrath for those who will just never come around. Because our lives are so short, it can seem like God is neglecting justice. But the truth is, we'll see one day that this life is a blink, and no one gets away with anything. Yahweh is working righteousness, and he is working justice for all who are oppressed by those who do evil. Verses 9 through 11 read, "He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love toward those who fear him." The phrase steadfast love, or as it's translated in other English Bibles, loving kindness, is a translation of the Hebrew word chesed. And this refers to God's faithful goodness and faithful kindness, just his reliable goodness, his reliable kindness. And it's associated with God's faithful, reliable blessing of Israel. Chesed is associated with his covenant of love for his people, his covenant relationship of expressed in love for his and blessing toward his people. He doesn't force humanity. He's never forced humanity to have a relationship with him. Even Israel, at the beginning of it all, was given the choice. whether or not they, you know, and they said, we'll do it. We'll obey. We'll do all this. Of course, they, you know, horribly failed repeatedly over and over again. And yet God was faithful in his commitment to the covenant with them. But he never forces anyone to have relationship with him. But for those who willingly enter covenant relationship with him, he gives unique commitments and blessings, such as withholding his wrath, as we see expressed here. Aren't you glad when it comes to his covenant people that he doesn't deal out to us what we deserve? Verse 17 and 18 read, "But the steadfast love of Yahweh is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to those who keep his covenant and remember to do his commandments." For Israel, being in covenant relationship with God involved obeying his commands, and in that process they experienced the blessings of seeing life accurately and doing life as we're meant to. Although today as Christians we don't lose God's gift of eternal life when we disobey, we do miss out on many of the blessings of being in obedient, trusting relationship with him. But if we willingly engage in obedient relationship with him, then we, like ancient Israel, experience the blessings of that, and our children do as well. There's a lot to be thankful for that we can easily take for granted that are the result of being in relationship with God. And as along with plenty of other things that are blessings God gives that are independent of our commitment to being in a relationship with him. I've started a thread in the Seeking Truth section of our forums at ChristianGeekCentral.com where you can go and openly thank God for whatever comes to mind as you think about how he's loved and blessed you. That's a really good and healthy thing to do, especially if you, like me, can just be a nattering nabob of negativity, which my mind can certainly go in a negative direction. And that's a really healthy and good thing to do, to think about, reflect on, and then express thanks for the ways that God is good to us and blesses us. It's a good idea not to neglect doing that. And in addition, that's praise and worship that God just frankly, he just deserves. He's the source of every good thing we have. And so he deserves thanks for every good thing that we experience. So you're invited to jump on that thread and share your thanks there. And for you overseas folks, this isn't about celebrating the American Thanksgiving holiday. I mean, I am tying it to that just kind of thematically for whatever. I guess that's kind of what you're supposed to do on podcasts is do that kind of thing. But but the reality is, I mean, this is something that we can and should do much more frequently than once a year. And Adam Collings from Australia has already shared some great things that he's thankful for. And so you're invited to do that as well, no matter where you are at in this on this planet. So let me just wrap up by reading again this psalm one more time while we each bring to mind what God has done and continues to do for us. Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits, who forgives all your iniquity, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with steadfast love and mercy, who satisfies you with good so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. Yahweh works righteousness and justice for all who are oppressed. He made known his ways to Moses, his acts to the people of Israel. Yahweh is merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. He will not always chide, nor will he keep his anger forever. He does not deal with us according to our sins, nor repay us according to our iniquities. For as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his steadfast love toward those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our transgressions from us. As a father shows compassion to his children, so Yahweh shows compassion to those who fear him. For he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field, for the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. but the steadfast love of Yahweh is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to children's children, to those who keep his covenant and remember to do his commandments. Yahweh has established his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom rules over all. Bless Yahweh, O you, his angels, you mighty ones who do his word, obeying the voice of his word. Bless Yahweh, all his hosts, his ministers who do his will. Bless Yahweh, all his works in all places of his dominion. Bless Yahweh, O my soul. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we... Dang it, I was doing so good! As fun and useful as we can. But we have to hear from you to do that. You can send an email or audio file recorded on your phone to paeter@spiritblade.com. All right, well, stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, guys, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, we'll see what shows up on the Christian Geek radar and hopefully get back into the book of Ephesians. Till then, please consider supporting the work of Christian Geek Central and Spirit Blade Productions by purchasing an audio drama, leaving a donation, or becoming a Spirit Blade Insider. You can get more information from our About page at spiritblade.com. Thank you so much, guys, for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Something's coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And that was Bar Association.
Man, it was pretty awful.
No pun intended, kind of a low bar for the season, too. This is the labor union episode where Rom, Quark's brother, because Quark is not treating his employees very well, he forms a, dare I say it? Am I allowed to use the word? A union. Yes, and it's so cartoonishly stupid. And, you know, this is Star Trek at its worst when it's doing a message show, is when it just says, it's between A and B on an issue. I know, let's say A is right, and all things about A are right, and anything relating to B is bad and stupid and awful.
Yeah, all the people on side A we will portray to be bordering on sainthood, and all the people on side B will be cackling and rubbing their fingers together and planning to eat kittens and kick grandmas.
And while Hitler is saying, boy, I'm glad I'm not one of those guys.
Yeah.
It's that overdone and stupid. And this is over the issue of labor unions, and guess what? It's a controversial issue for a reason, like most of your controversial issues, because it's complex. And what Kim and I were watching in all this is tearing apart everything Rom does. And by the end of the show, he's literally quoting from the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so... Okay, Quark, at the very beginning, Rom gets so sick that he nearly dies. And Quark is just really cold-hearted about it. And he's a villain. Later on, after the Ferengi authorities get a hold and nearly beat Quark to death, Rom is sitting there while Quark is all bruised in the hospital, and Rom is saying, "Oh, good, this happened to you. You deserve it."
Yeah.
And he's the good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope it hurts more. And it's, I usually like Rom, but this episode he really ticked me off. Because he's such a hypocrite. He keeps talking about how you need, it's all about serving the needs of the people and all the masses. But at the very end of the show, without any warning, he just quits on his brother to go do what's good for him. So it's like, well, so much for helping your fellow worker.
Yeah, so much for strength together. And,
yeah. Workers of the world unite until I get me a better job. Then I'm out of here with no warning.
Screw you guys. Yeah. Well, there's a part where the Ferengi authorities show up to break up the union. And we were joking about how earlier, the Ferengi can't even bring themselves to say the word.
Yeah, it's like this childish, it's like Voldemort and Harry Potter, only at least that has magic behind it.
Yeah.
And they literally say, like, Rom says, we're going to form a union. He goes, you've just ruined us all. Yeah. You said the U-word.
You said the word. Now they'll come kill us all. Everybody was in the room when someone said the word. It's like,
so apparently you can't talk about the Civil War around these people.
Well, yeah, apparently if you want to ruin any Ferengi's life, just say the U-word within earshot.
It's like, oh,
it'll ruin them.
It's so cartoonish. All it is we want to say, the Ferengi are so corrupt, even the word union is anathema to me.
But yeah, they're freaking out about this, and the Ferengi authorities finally show up.
And they've got a couple big brute aliens,
yeah, they've got some big, you know, knuckle-dragging Nausicaans to be their muscle. And they essentially say, okay, break this up or else. And one of the Ferengi waiters just throws himself on the ground in front of the authorities, you know, not quite weeping, but almost there, just, have mercy, I'll never do it again, please, please. And after the authorities leave, Rom just throws this guy out of their organization, essentially. He says, one of the others says,
leave him where he belongs.
Yeah, should we get him up? He's like, no, leave him where he belongs. You know, it's like, this man, in a moment of terror,
you know, over literal death.
Yeah. Gave, you know, just in fear, backed down, and Rom abandons him. It's like that scene in the third X-Men movie where Magneto's like, oh, she's not one of us anymore. Forget her.
And guess what? That was a very low thing of Magneto, and uncharacteristic of him, too.
Yeah.
That was not meant to be, look how noble Magneto is. But it was supposed to be that for Rom. He's supposed to be like, oh, he's so noble, he cares about the cause.
This whole story is trying to play Rom up as a budding charismatic leader, and I'm like, this is not the way to do it, buddy. You can't
throw your people under the bus as soon as they don't follow your agenda.
No, you gotta inspire them to bravery. You're not doing it.
And it's so bad that if you actually use this as an issue for labor negotiations and unions and all that issue, it's really gonna look more like this is coming up anti-union because it's so badly done. And like I say, it's also not very interesting, and that's another problem. You wanna know how uninteresting it is? There's a subplot in this episode. And it's because Worf is not feeling happy on the station. It's a little over halfway through the season now, so he's been here for half a season, several months, and he is just not fitting in. And there's a great scene where someone has broken into his house, and Odo is, he's confronting Odo like he did at the very beginning of the season, same thing about, how could you let this happen? And the way that Odo looks, he has a smile on his face, and he pulls out, he's got a pad, just, you knew he was waiting, he had this thing ready.
He reaches over to the side, he grabs his thing off the other end of his desk, and he goes,
he had this ready.
Worf says, this sort of thing never happened on the Enterprise. No.
Oh,
really?
Let's look at this episode guide for the Next Generation here. And he just lists two events.
A list.
And it's a great moment. And Odo and Worf says, okay, you're right. But again, that whole subplot, which is basically Worf is looking for a new apartment, is far more entertaining than the main plot. It's like, thrill as Worf looks through the weekly ads and circles the right apartments.
No mechlets allowed. Screw that one. Right.
But, yeah, I found it, you know, part of it is my own political leanings. I'll admit that. I'm pretty right-wing. But it's also just, it's not, they don't portray it as any kind of a dilemma. They act like only an idiot wouldn't already agree with us. And there's a reason this is controversial. There's a reason this is a debate. And part of it is that they go right from, we're so destitute that he's cutting our ability to live, to, we need paid vacation. And it's like, you don't do that. You look like a bunch of entitled babies. You don't look like people fighting for your right to earn a decent wage. You look like people who just want to squeeze everything you can out of them. Guess what? That's what you claim the bad guy is doing. So how are you better? And there's a term for this called protagonist-centered morality, where everything that we do is okay because we're doing it. And it's considered terrible storytelling. You know, in a good story, you can tell the good guys from the bad guys, and it's not just whose point of view you're looking at. The idea that if you flip the story around, you might be able to understand why the villain's doing it, but that doesn't make the villain okay. For example, Gul Dukat. Sometimes we get into his head and we see things from his perspective, but at no point do we think, oh, well, maybe he was right to actually sit there and murder all those people and rape them.
Yeah, it's like, you think, I can totally understand why he took slave mistresses.
Yeah. You think, well, now I know his point of view and I understand it, and he's not just a cackling villain, but he's still a villain. And that's the problem with this, is in many ways, Rom is acting just as villainous, if not worse, than the bad guys, especially his brother. Because, again, his brother is trying to give in to protect him, and then he turns around and Quark is trying to protect his brother as much as he's trying to protect his prophets, and Rom is saying, let my brother die, it's okay.
Yeah.
And he's the good guy in this. And of course, there's a moment, I already talked about this on my worst messages, POSTOS, and this one always got on my nerves. There's a part where, because O'Brien and Bashir are just cheering Rom on, and just, you know, putting their fingers all in his pie,
yeah,
and getting
O'Brien
stirred up.
Kind of helping agitate for this, because he had an ancestor who was in a coal miners' union in Pennsylvania, and he's helping Rom basically get ideas for the story.
And Rom just goes insane and says, we need to be like Sean O'Brien all the time.
Yep.
But so they're sitting there outside Quark's, and they're taking bets on who's going to go in. Oh, that Vulcan. Oh, Vulcans are ethical. They won't go in. Oh, these aliens are, you know. And then they see Worf going in and say, oh, well, no, he's not going to go in. And he goes in. And so what does O'Brien do? He goes around and starts pushing Worf around.
He picks a fight with Worf.
Which, being stupid in and of itself, again, how are you better than the other guys using intimidation? It's like, it's the hypocrisy of it that bothers me. It's not the stance they take. I don't mind if they take a stance I don't agree with. I mind when they use hypocritical methods and they just say, we're right because we say we are. That bothers me.
Now, I did appreciate that Sisko had absolutely no patience for them.
Yeah. Yeah, Sisko, as usual, handled things well.
He comes and sees them in the holding cell, and he's like, no, we're not having this from either of you. This is unacceptable.
Well, another part I really liked was Sisko is talking to Quark, saying, you need to solve this. We can't have this keep going on. But he doesn't just say, you jump in line with what I say. He says, well, if you want to do this capitalism thing, we haven't charged you rent or utilities or repair bills. Here's your back rent due. So if you want to be capitalists, then we'll be capitalists. Or we can get along together and help each other out.
Yeah.
So you need it. It's like, that's fair. That's good. That's meeting where he is.
I'll play by Ferengi rules. I'll play by Ferengi rules,
yeah.
Bob.
And that's completely fair, because he has given them 5 years worth of free rent at a business. You know, all this stuff. It's like, great. So again, Sisko was a good part of this episode. He's very rarely not a good part. Guess who my favorite captain is, if you didn't already know. So, yeah, I would recommend you skip this, because the only thing that you need to know by the end that's changed in this episode is
Rom quits the bar,
and again, without any notice to his brother, screw you, and now he's working as station engineering. So, you know what, you can figure it out when you just see him doing engineering stuff. So you don't really need to see this episode. Other than that,
we recommend you pass.
Yeah. I mean, you have Jeffrey Combs as a guest star, and it still is lame. How bad is that?
Yeah.
If you can't do well with Jeffrey Combs, you're just doing something wrong.
You have failed at life.
So next time, we've got an emissary story. So we'll see you for Accession.